So here we are today for another episode of the Adelaide Entrepreneur Podcast. And today we have with us David Berkus, all the way from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'll just talk a little bit about David. So you've got a bit of background. I'll just read out a bit about David. So David's one of the world's leading business thinkers. David Berkus, forward-thinking ideas and best-selling books are helping leaders and teams do their best work ever. He is the best-selling author of four books about business and leadership. His books have won multiple awards and have been translated into dozens of languages. His insights on leadership and teamwork have been featured in the Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, US Today, Fast Company, the Financial Times, Bloomberg Businessweek, CNN, the BBC, NPR, and CBS This Morning. Quite a list. In 2017, Berkus has been ranked as one of the world's top business thought leaders by organisations like Thinkers 50, Global Gurus, and the Leaders Hum. As a sought-after international speaker, his TED Talk has been viewed over 2 million times. He has worked with leaders from organisations across all industries, including Google, Stryker, Fidelity, Viacom, and even the US Naval Academy. Wow, quite an introduction there. So,
yeah, well, I realized as you were reading all that media, nothing from Australia in media. So we're going to have to add the Adelaide Entrepreneurs Podcast just to represent the whole continent, right?
Yep. Yeah. I got most of it except for NPR. I had no idea what NPR was.
Ah, so that's National Public Radio. So that's the U. It's sort of like the US version of the BBC.
Right. Okay, cool.
Although nowhere near as good as the people, to be honest with you.
Cool. Look, again, thanks, David. And I just thought we'd just start with, you know, you've written five books now. There's, you're doing lots of keynote speaking. You're going into lots of companies. So I'm just curious about how you started out and how you got to the point to write your first book, and then we can go into some of the books that you wrote about.
Yeah. Well, geez, how much time do you have? Right. Right. if you want to go back all the way to sort of primary school, right. I graduated out of primary school and went to university to be a writer. Right. So writing books was always part of the plan.
Oh, right.
18-year-old me had no idea it would be this genre, if you will. Right. When you're 18 years old, you think I'm going to write fiction. That's all, you know, textbooks are the only nonfiction you know, and they're boring. Who would ever want to write those, right? So went to university to study that. Along the way, kind of discovered organizational psychology, but too late to sort of switch majors and that sort of thing. And so decided like, wow, I'm fascinated with this research. I'm fascinated with some of the early social science writers who are out there, people publishing stuff in the late 90s, early 2000s. And decided that's what I want to do. Right. And so what do you do when you only are half qualified for what you're supposed to do? You do more school. Right. So I went to graduate school to study organizational psychology, did a master's, started a PhD program, was never planning on becoming a business school professor, but it was the easier sort of on ramp into writing and speaking and all that sort of stuff. So as I was finishing up the doctorate, started teaching, and then that turned into a full time business school position for about 6 years as I grew out what I would call the writing and speaking side of the business, if you will. I say side of the business. By the time I left, it's now the only side of the business. There's one side to the whole business, right? But so it was kind of like trying to get that off the ground while trying to be a professor. And now they've sort of switched, and being a professor is almost a side hustle, and writer speaker is full time. But yeah, it's been an interesting journey. The not too well broadcasted fact of it all is that being a writer was always part of the plan, and every other path to get there was kind of accidental.
Right. So, and that came from when you were young, that desire to write, or was it about a specific subject that you desired to write?
Yeah, no, just the desire to be a writer, right? So I went to lots of different young writers' conferences and met a lot of really cool, some fairly big name fiction authors and that sort of stuff. And was just kind of obsessed with that world of writing and publishing. And that's what I wanted to do at university. The organizational psychology, the doing all of this work on helping teams and leaders and that sort of stuff, that came later when it was sort of like, well, what do you want to write about? Yep. I became kind of fascinated with this subject and really fascinated with, so in the late 90s, early, so this is like Gladwell's first book came out while I was in university, right? And the idea that you could weave the storytelling tools and techniques that I had learned as an undergraduate, studying how to write fiction, weave that in with writing about studies and social science and things that's actually kind of useful to people and businesses trying to improve themselves. I'd never been shown that until then. And then as soon as I saw it, I was like, that's it. That's the thing, right? It's not writing fiction, whatever, it's that.
Right. Cause when I read Friends of a Friend of a Friend, well, that's what I found the most interesting, is the stories that you spoke about, the real life examples. Mm-hmm. And then you gave, based on that and the science behind that and the real life example, this is the action that you would take. I found that very, very interesting, to read. And the examples are amazing.
that's part of the most fun. It's the two big fun things about my job, right, is I get to be kind of constantly sifting through all of the different research to find the insights that are kind of new and counterintuitive and make us rethink things about the world. But then I also get to always be hearing all of these different crazy stories and filing them away. And then sometimes actually getting to reach out and interview these people, and they end up in the book. And it's just like, it blows my mind, right? And why would you ever want to write, when I look back at it 20 something years later, and I'm like, why would you ever want to write fiction? The real world is so fascinating and so full of crazy stories, right? Let's just tell those.
Yeah, probably so more crazy that if people didn't know they were true, they would just read it as fiction.
Yeah.
So how did you get into this type of field then? Like what was the turning point that, you decided you wanted to write? How did you get to writing about this particular subject?
Well, I mean, it's funny. In the beginning, it was just sort of intellectual ADHD, right? So before I had a book contract, I was trying to read as much as possible, collect as many stories as possible, read as many journal articles and studies as possible. And so I wrote about all sorts of stuff. Like if you go back into my early writing for first for 99U and then HBR and then like a couple pieces for the Wall Street Journal and that sort of thing. If you go back and look at the early writing, it's all over the place, right? There's no through line through it. It's just sort of like, what subject is Dave fascinated with this week? And that's the article, right? You look back and I realize that the through line through all of these is really kind of teams and the collective dynamic, how people interact with each other, how they collaborate, how they keep each other motivated, how they build bonds, all of that, right? And so that's everything from, The Myths of Creativity, which was my first book, which was this, where this phrase was born, creativity is a team sport, but really everything about life is a team sport, right? And so in Under New Management, we talked about different ways to organize people, and Friend of a Friend, sort of Friend of a Friend is kind of two books, right? So the first part of it is a very personal, the people around you, the network around you. You could almost look at that as kind of a professional networking book. And the second half of the book is kind of the network of an organization, the network of how teams form, et cetera. And then the new one, Leading From Anywhere, is all about teams, but in the remote context. What are the companies that pre-pandemic were already choosing to collaborate virtually for most of their interactions? What was working for them? And what does the research say? So that through line of teams, it's like that what's that Jobs quote about, you can only connect the dots looking backward, you can't connect them looking forward. Yeah. That's kind of been the big insight for me over the last 2 or 3 years, is like, oh, what seemed like it was all scatterbrained and all over the place, the thing that actually ties them together is I'm fascinated with the science behind how people connect with each other and work together effectively, hopefully, for a common goal, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's incredible. Like you said, it's amazing how you just keep moving forward, but it's not until enough time passes, you look back, that you can go, is that how it all worked out? That's how it was all meant to be.
Yeah, totally. Right. And that's also every entrepreneur's journey, right? How many pivots are involved before you stumble into, like, maybe your business model doesn't change, but your target market changes, or maybe your target market stays the same. But there's all sorts of little pivots until you find it. And then when it clicks in, you're like, oh, it makes perfect sense why it was always this. Yeah.
Yeah. And what was your first book, out of curiosity?
So the first one was The Myths of Creativity, right? Which was a collection of a lot of different research on creativity and innovation, organized around 10 different misconceptions. One of them being what we call the lone creator myth. And the truth of that is that all creative ideas are actually generated by a team, or at least you're influenced by other people you might as well recognize that and seek to surround yourself with a diverse set of people to get more ideas from, right? So, So The Myth of Creativity was the first book.
Oh, cool. And the first time I heard about you was, I was interested in when I heard the title Friend of a Friend, because I met a guy in the UK, well, Don and I met a guy in the UK by Zoom, Martin, and he said, oh, I've been reading a great book by this guy called David Berkus, Friend of a Friend. So we got hold of Friend of a Friend and read it. And then we reached out to yourself to catch up and have a talk. And, you know, so that whole concept of a friend of a friend I thought was fascinating. And then reading that particular book was really an interesting read. And I really do like what you say at the end of the book, which is essentially the line, you know, your friend of a friend is your future. Well, that's just how you finish up the book, and it's so true. I believe, you know, you're getting out there and connecting with people is such an important thing to do. And there was a couple of things in that book I found examples of that I just found really fascinating. And the first one was, we'd all heard about it before, but it was the first time I ever heard it explained in the book, and that was the Kevin Bacon effect.
Yeah, the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, yeah. Yeah, this is an interesting, so 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon is a riff on a well-researched, well-documented phenomenon known as 6 degrees of separation, right? The people, the movie buffs who were so fascinated with films, with Hollywood films in particular, started to feel like Kevin Bacon was some uber-connected person that was, you know, at the center of the Hollywood universe. The truth is, it was totally random. It was just the fact that they had watched 3 Kevin Bacon movies in a row and he stood out. And the research behind it, and when the same data scientists who were studying 6 degrees of separation took the Hollywood database and did the same thing, the reality is the reason it happens isn't that there's anything special about Kevin Bacon or you or me or anyone else, but that people really actually are 5 to 6 introductions away from each other. What happens is what they kind of call the small world effect, right? You have these usually weak ties, acquaintances, connections, people you don't talk to all that often. Your friend Martin in London, for example, right? Yep. And those people act as bridges for you to a whole new world, right? So all you actually need is one person who changed jobs or changed industries or changed continents, whatever it is. All you need is one person who changed jobs. And now as they make new connections, you are 1 degree of separation out from those people, even if you've never kind of met them, right? And so what I find fascinating about this, like I said, is not that Kevin's the center of it or that anybody's the center of it. It's A, the fact that it exists. And then if you do the numbers, if you think about your professional network, this is what I am probably think the biggest implication for most people is that you think about the power of these weak ties, you have tens of millions of potential introductions that are 1 degree of separation out from you. You don't have to go 6 handshakes and suddenly you're meeting the president or the prime minister. I don't want to meet those people of any country. I don't care. Right. But if you think about it, if you're trying to research a new market or you're trying to learn more about a certain industry, et cetera, and you just ask an open-ended question of your existing contacts, hey, who do you know in whatever? Who do you know in this industry? Who do you know in what have you? You'll get a whole lot more people than you probably anticipated. They'd either have a name to give you and an introduction to make, or, you know what? I've got this friend Martin in London. And because he's in London, I bet he knows an awful lot about how the Queen and the royal family work. So let me ask Martin and see if he can connect you with anyone who's a specialist on the royal family's genealogy. I'm just making this one up because Martin was in London, right? But you get the idea, right? Yeah. And I think that's fascinating. Yeah, it's fascinating that people are 5 or 6 introductions away from everybody else. But what's more fascinating is just how many mathematically are just 1 degree out because of those bridges to all of the whole new world of people that happen anytime somebody makes a change in their life.
Yeah, I find that just such an exciting concept because, you know, people always ask me, you know, why do you keep wanting to connect with people? And I just share with them that, you know, there's things out there and opportunities that you and I just don't know about. And the only way you're going to find out about them is someone that you have yet to meet. Because if everyone you knew of that particular opportunity that you didn't know about, then they would have let you know by now.
Yes. So yeah.
People that you're yet to meet are the most important people for you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I wrote the book, so obviously we're in agreement here, right? But for those listening, yeah, but how many of us do it the opposite way, right? How many times have you, like on LinkedIn, for example, been on the receiving end of one of those LinkedIn stalkers that's like, hey, Stephen, I noticed that you're connected to so-and-so. Would you introduce me, right? We often we start with a target person in our mind and then we try and work backwards to find that person. And you want to just kind of shake them and go, okay, well, A, number one, like I may or may not be comfortable introducing you to that person. So that's like rule number one. Maybe we don't have enough of a bond here where I feel comfortable introducing you. But the bigger, more important rule is rule number two, which is why are you limiting yourself to this one person you want to meet? If you took an open posture and just became fascinated with making new connections every once in a while and just kind of learning who and what potentials are at the fringes of your network, you'd never need that introduction. You'd already sort of know the path to that person, right? Yeah. So, and we see this in the data, by the way. So the early studies of this phenomenon, 6 degrees of separation, were done in a reverse format, right? They would say something like, they would pick a random person, like a stockbroker in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the United States. And then they'd pick a bunch of people and they'd say, here's the person, get this letter to him. And if you don't know him, send it to someone you think may be able to find a path to that person, right? Fast forward 40 years, and we have things like algorithms that can crawl an entire network in a short period of time. So for example, if you have a Facebook account still, if you're one of the people, your number shrinks to 4.2. You are 4.2 introductions away. Now, the reason for that is that the Facebook algorithm can crawl every possible route to that person and find the most efficient one, right? Whereas these people doing the early studies had to take one guess. So, okay, what do you want to do? Do you want to take one guess? Do you want to find that one person and try and find a path? Or do you just want to have an open posture towards everyone and just say, hey, who do you know in this industry? And ask that of lots of different people and make those new connections without any expectation of gain, just a desire to learn. That's going to work a whole lot better. I can't turn you into a Facebook algorithm that can crawl the whole network, but I can say, keep an open posture and a lot of good things will happen.
Oh, cool. Yeah. No, thanks for that. And that whole mind concept of, you know, go out there and put in the effort of connecting without expecting a return.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a whole other rant we could go on. Yeah.
The one thing in the book that I've spoken about a lot, because it sort of indicates to people an example of how you actually go out and connect with people, but there was a bit in the book where there were a guy spoke about the influencer's dinner.
Mm. Yes, John Levy.
That is an amazing, if you could share about that, David, that would be awesome.
Yeah, John is a fascinating guy. And by the way, not to plug someone else's book on your show, but that's just how generous I am. John has now written a book called You're Invited, which is all about the influencer's dinner and how he makes connections and his sort of take on a lot of this research, which is a great, great read called You're Invited. So John was... I don't know, I'll say it in the most blunt way. John was kind of a nobody for a long time, just kind of one of the millions of young professionals who live in New York City and have a light amount of connections, but nothing all that influential, and had an idea of what kind of business he wanted to start, but nothing all that significant. And so he started realizing he wanted to kind of expand his network to improve his life by connecting to more people. The quality of the relationships he was going to have was going to influence his life. So he wanted to make a deliberate effort to do that. And so he started throwing dinner parties. And this is not new, right? People throw dinner parties all the time, right? People get together and bond over community. But what John did was John took a lot of the research in behavioral science that he was already studying as part of his job as a consultant in behavioral science and kind of flipped it. And so he played, there's a couple different games to the influencer's dinner that makes it a great time for the guests, makes it the guests more likely to want to invite other people. And also just kind of makes for deeper bonds, right? So the first thing is you come and John, you know, when he started, these people weren't all that influential. He was aspiring to have them be influencers. But you come and the first thing John will tell you is you are not allowed to use anything other than your first name. Don't tell us your title. Don't tell us your last name. Nothing we could use to Google you and figure out who you are. Let's just go by first names. The second thing he's going to tell you is you have been paired up with someone else And we will, for the next hour, we will be cooking dinner together. So you're not going to be served dinner. We'll be cooking it. I've planned everything out. Here's your task. You're making the salad, or you're in charge of braising the chicken, or whatever it is, right? And so you are now, for the next hour, you're partnered with one, sometimes two people who don't, you can't use the standard questions of like, so what do you do? And all of that sort of stuff. But you make conversation as you're engaging in this task, right? And you learn all sorts of things about them that you wouldn't otherwise do, because you normally pick up that script we all pick up and use, right? And then they sit down after an hour, they have dinner, and they kind of play this little game where they try and guess what people actually do. And over time, this created such an enjoyable experience that people started referring guests to John. And now John's having these dinners, and this is pre-COVID, although it's starting to pick back up now. On any given dinner, you could have like, okay, this person works for a major television network, and this person is the Duke of a Scandinavian country you've never heard of, and this person is Beyonce's hairstylist, and this, like, just these incredibly influential people. But you connected with them on a human dynamic first, not just that script of who, what's your title, and all of that sort of stuff, which can really get in the way of building authentic connections.
Yeah, that was the exact point, was, you know, that example of really connecting with people, but without going to what do you do first? Because that's, you know, you go to anyone that you meet today, they try and put you in that box, I guess, because the mind just wants to make it simple by, you know, tell me what you're doing, and then I think I know about you. But there's so much more to people than what they do. That was just such a great example. How did you come across, how did you, did you know him, or did you just find that through research? Or?
Well, John and I are friends now, but we had a friend of a friend at the time. There was a podcaster who's also in the book, actually. The podcaster Jordan Harbinger is the one who introduced me. I'm pretty sure, actually, now that I say that, I would assume it was Jordan, who introduced me to John, because I was talking about the Network Science book and making connections. And he was basically like, oh, well, you got to talk to my buddy, John. And then through John, I also met Chris Shembra, who's also in the book. And Chris does his own variation of this that he calls the 747 Club. Same idea, but what I love about, so John has this sort of rich, elaborate, multi-course meal that you're all making together in an hour. Chris does his in 13 minutes. It's called the 747 Club because it takes exactly 13 minutes to cook two boxes of pasta al dente, and dinner is served at 8, right? So the idea is you show up around 7:30, right? And we still got tasks for you to do, but it's a much shorter period of time. And then usually Chris's expertise now is in facilitating the discussion, right? But either side are sort of proof of concept. You don't need anything. I went to one of Chris's dinners, and at the time it was in like a 500 square foot studio apartment that like put the Murphy bed up on the wall and put out a card table, but it was still like a rich and deep experience because we had been engaged in it, far more so than if we had just like booked a corner table at some random restaurant.
Yeah. That's amazing. And the other story that you know, things you just don't ever get the chance to go and do your own research on, but you just have a concept of what they know about today, and that's the most famous smile in the world. I thought that was... That was just...
Well, yeah. is it a smile or is it a smirk? Right? So we're talking, for those of you that are like, what the heck are they talking about? So we're talking about the Mona Lisa. Fascinating thing about the Mona Lisa, probably most, I won't say most famous painting, most visited painting of all time. People, and it's not a large painting if you've ever seen it. It's actually, I saw it in person. It's actually a little disappointing, right? Because you get there and it's the size of maybe like an A4 piece of paper. Like it's not really that much bigger. You think it's going to be this
huge.
No, it's not that big. Okay, maybe I'm exaggerating. It might be a little bigger than an A4 piece of paper, but it's not that big. And it also isn't that special, or at least it wasn't for the first 100 years after it was painted. It was just hanging in some Duke's random hallway and that sort of thing. It wasn't until it was hanging in the Louvre, and it wasn't until it was stolen by two Italians who wanted to bring it back to Italy because it was Da Vinci's. They wanted to smuggle it back to the home country. That then created this whole story about the Mona Lisa that created this sort of self-perpetuating thing, right? So no one ever cared about this painting. And then because it was bright line and everybody was sort of exposed to it and heard about it, then when it came back, everybody wanted to see it. And then you have art experts who are examining it a bit more closely. And now, of course, you talk to experts and like, oh, well, of course, because it's this brilliant and this and Britain. You want to go, okay, well, how come nobody thought that for the first 100 years, right? And I think it's a good example for two reasons. Like one is this idea that things compound, right? That your interest, the more you're exposed to something, the more likely you are to like it, the bigger affinity you have for it, et cetera. So sometimes if you're just trying to get along, if you're trying to get connected to someone, sometimes just repeated exposure to them will make them like you, right? That's like small scale lesson. Larger scale lesson though, is that networks work the exact same way. People's relationship compound. And so in network science, we have this term called super connectors, people who are have an abnormal number of collections, the Mona Lisas of the professional network, if you will. But often what propelled them there wasn't massive networking skills. They weren't this perfect. It was sort of like a combination of effort and luck, right? Because it takes effort to smuggle a painting to Italy. Actually, they never actually got it to Italy, but that's a whole other thing. What happens is as somebody gets more connections, they get new connections faster. Makes perfect sense, right? So even the more people that you know and the more people you're keeping up connections with, the more likely it is someone's going to go, oh, you know what? You should talk to my buddy, Steven. It makes perfect sense, right? But we never think about that in terms of networks and also in terms of why some people it seems so easy for and other people really struggle to make connections. Now, there is an introversion, extroversion thing there and all that sort of thing. But sometimes you feel like you're rolling the ball up the hill just to make the effort to meet all sorts of new people. And then you look to someone who's 20 years down the road and has all of these random random lottery-like moments, like a painting being stolen. And they have all of these networks and you're like, why can't I be that person? Well, it's a combination of luck and effort. So keep going and you'll keep compounding the connections that you have. And maybe you'll stumble into some lucky moments as you do. And 20 years from now, maybe even 15 years from now, somebody else who's starting out growing their professional network is going to look at you and go, oh my gosh, that person it's so easy for. Why can't it be that easy for me? Right?
Yeah. It's so easy to look at the end product, like, you know, just the Mona Lisa and go, I'd love to create a painting that was so famous. In reality, you just got to create something and get it stolen. To create that.
I suppose there's also, you know, we talk in Friend of a Friend, we talk a bit too about what we call the majority illusion, which is almost more of a marketing than a professional network lesson. But it's this idea that if you have the right influencers or the right people who are connected speaking your praises, you're actually a whole lot more influential than your initial networks may have, right? So John Levy is a great example of this person, right? John Levy's not famous. He doesn't have a million TikTok followers or what have you, but he's connected and he's on the minds and on the lips of a lot of people who are outwardly influential. And as a result, he has a whole lot more influence than we thought, right? In this case, the painting being stolen is what got the Mona Lisa talked about by all of these papers and all of these art magazines and journals in the first place. But it didn't matter. Once they were talking about it, people just kept talking, right?
Yeah. And just from your perspective in writing Friend of a Friend, what was the subject matter in there that you got most excited about, or what's the subject matter that got the most feedback as well?
I can't speak to feedback because it kind of runs, like I said, it's sort of organized like two different books, and so people take it in two different ways. I can answer what I'm most fascinated about, and you hinted at it earlier, which is that closing phrase of the book, "Your friend of a friend is your future," comes from a couple different studies around what's known as the 3 degrees of influence. First coined by Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler, who ran a couple different studies based on this heart study called the Framingham Heart Study, which was in Framingham, Massachusetts, here in the United States. There was an effort to basically follow tens of thousands of people throughout their entire life and figure out what lifestyle choices and risk factors were correlated with what diseases of the heart, right? And so the Framingham Heart Study is where we found out, hey, blood pressure matters, cholesterol matters, but they asked a whole lot more questions than just that. And so Chrysagus and Fowler got their hands on that data and they're like, hey, they're asking questions here about social connections and they're asking questions about habits and hobbies, and maybe we can reanalyze this data. And so they ran it with one of the most obvious ones first. They ran it with smoking. And they found that people who were like listed, if you said you smoked in yours and a bunch of other people listed you as a close contact, right? Those people were more likely to already be smokers or become smokers over time. In other words, if a decent percentage of your friends smoked, you were more likely to smoke. Now that's peer pressure. We all went through primary school. We all know what that's about. Here's where it gets interesting. They found that even if your close circle of friends doesn't smoke, but a lot of their friends do, you are more likely over the course of your lifespan to develop the habit of smoking. And the inverse too, if it works the opposite way, you're more likely to quit smoking if most of those people don't, right? So in other words, not just the people you're connected to, but the people you're about to be connected to, the people who are at the fringes of your network that you might be introduced to, also have an influence on you, right? So this is why your friend of a friend is your future is a riff on this old line from Jim Rohn about, you know, show me your friends and I'll show you your future. Jim's line is you're the average of the five people you interact with the most. Jim's not wrong, but it's actually your influences are way more significant than that. They come from way more angles from that. And you need to kind of pay attention to that. And that's a reason to do what you do and constantly be exploring the fringes of your network, especially for the people who are doing the things you want to do, who represent the type of person you want to become. You want to be looking for people who are like that and who are connected to people who are like that, because that'll guide your future more so than even some of your individual choices.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Yeah, no, it's a subject that I believe needs to be instilled in people as early as they can, that skill or that understanding of connecting with people is your life can change by someone that you meet. Like your whole direction of your life can change from someone that you don't know.
What's weird about that, right, isn't that that can happen, but that the numbers, the odds, the statistics point to the fact that you're already connected to the person who's going to bring that person into your life, right? So it's not like fluke meetings and circumstances happen. Yep. You're already probably connected to that person.
Yes.
And so if that one's happening by serendipity, how many more serendipitous moments could you create just by keeping an open posture to how you cultivate your network?
Yep. Out of your, and I know this is like a crazy question, but out of the five books that you have written, which one, was there one that meant more to you to write? Was there one that you more enthusiastic about? Or
So which of my kids is my favorite? Is that what you're basically asking? So, like the typical dad answer, they're all special in their own way. I will tell you this: I have a special place in my mind, possibly my heart, for the audio book, the project we did with Audible called Pick a Fight. Pick a Fight is how great teams find a cause worth rallying around or worth fighting for, right? And it's essentially about purpose, but it's about the way that we frame purpose. That matters, right? I felt like a lot of people were bought in on this idea that we need to start with why, that we need to have a purpose statement or a mission statement. We need to know why we're doing what we're doing in business or what have you. But everybody's answers were all sorts of different, and some were more powerful than others. So I felt like we needed an explanation of like, okay, well, what makes for a more powerful one? And so I started to use this metaphor of a fight. Like, can you answer the question, what are we fighting for? Not who are we fighting, like competition, right? But what are we fighting for? What's the cause that our business is structured around or that our team is working for, et cetera. So I became fascinated with that idea and I pitched it to the publisher that I've been partnered with for almost a decade now. And they said, no, they said, sounds too similar to stuff people have already done. We're not sure about the market on it. We pass. And so I had kind of a decision to make around what do we do? Do we leave that publisher and go to a different one? You know, at that point, once they reject it, it's sort of like, I don't know, it's like a lot of other things. Once they decide, no, we don't want your current book, your contract obligations to them are over, and you can go find another publisher if you want. And so what I decided to do was I said, well, let me just write it to figure out what it is. Like, let me just write the book. This doesn't happen in nonfiction publishing, by the way. A little inside baseball, I guess I should say inside cricket here. Normally with a nonfiction publisher, you write a proposal, you write an outline of what the book's going to look like. Here's a marketing plan. Here's who I am. Here's the business plan for the book. And then a publisher says, yes, here's some money. Go write it. We'll publish it, right? You don't write the book first. No one ever writes the book first. I decided this time to write the book first. And when I did write the book and I kind of like got it out of me and just figured out what it was half the size of a normal book. So then I was like, well, shoot, now I have no idea what to do, right? Because it's, of course, they're not going to buy it. It's not even the length of a book. It's half the length of the book. But we managed to talk Audible into partnering with us on it. Of what if we just made it an audiobook? We're targeting leaders anyway. They listen to audio more than the other two formats of books. So let's release it with Audible, exclusive to them as a special thing, which was really kind of exciting to partner with them on. And so we launched it. We launched it February 27th or 25th, February 25th, 2020. 2 weeks later, the world ended. Nobody cared, right? Nobody listened to audiobooks anymore. Nobody was listening to podcasts. Everybody was staying at home, right? Sheltering in place, the whole deal. And so to this day, it is the least known about of any of my books, but it was fun because it was one of those, like, I have this idea and I can't focus on anything else until I get this idea out of my head and make it. So I made it and it came to life in a different way than a traditional book. But I enjoy it for that reason, that it was just totally different from what I was expecting.
And that's an interesting subject, purpose. A lot of the people that we have spoken to, like people, you know, I hear a lot about, you know, I've got to know my purpose, and then I've got to know what that is. And it, literally people are saying, I've got to know what it is before I do anything. And most of the people we've spoken to that have developed anything significant really didn't know what direction they were going. But what they did do is they just kept moving forward. They just kept on doing something. And then eventually, you know, that path became evident, whatever that path was.
Yeah.
I think that I like that concept of, you know, what are you fighting for?
Yeah, you know, and I think here we often confuse purpose and mission too, right? Which are two, this is me sounding like a B-school professor for a second, which are two different things, right? So if you're looking for purpose, I like to question, what are we fighting for? What injustice in the world are we trying to turn around? Or really what I've been diving into recently is the research around how motivating it is to give someone a purpose that answers the question, who is served by the work that we're looking to do? So just who are we trying to serve, right? Who in the world are we? Is it customers? Is it stakeholders by having a different business model and all that? And then mission is the, how are we going to do that, right? So once we know this is the cause that we're about, you still have to settle on the, how are we going to do, right? And I think that lack of mission is where a lot of people are like, well, I can't even start until I figure it out. And often you can get going down what looks like a worthy effort and discover that it's a mission, and that by doing the mission, there's a whole group of people that are served by it. So you can go backwards too, right? I'm in favor of either one, but that's so I look at it not so much as people say, oh, I can't even start till I have it figured out. Okay. And other people figure it out and then start, just like what you said, right? Yep. The difference to me is I think what people think is that it's supposed to be one unique thing, but it can be totally different things. Who is served by the work that you do? I mean, if I look at my own life, my own career, my own business, I have one who, but I have two missions, right? I have one who of who is served. I'm trying to work with specifically with leaders and teams to help people do their best work ever is the line that I use often. That's my who. The mission is a little bit different. I want to be a successful author. I also want to be a successful keynote speaker and trainer. Like, those are different markets, if you will. Those are different. So those create different hows that I go about doing it. So yeah, you could go either way. I think most people, though, they need to know the answer to both questions before they can feel deeply passionate about their work. But I don't think sitting around and waiting for the answer to both questions is worthwhile either.
Yeah, because when you hear people's stories, in some cases they had to go down a particular path first, which gave them enough information or enough skills to then take advantage of something that's now that appears, where if they didn't go down that path and they're presented, they wouldn't have had the ability to even recognize it.
Yeah.
Awesome. Look, just to, I guess, to wrap this up, David, and bring it to some conclusion, what is it, what's something that you want to, what's a, like a topic that's dear to your heart or something you'd like to share? You know, what's something that's close to your mind at the moment?
So, I mean, that who question is what I'm focusing a lot of my time right now researching and thinking about. How do we get better at talking about purpose as who is served by the work that we do? The other through line through a lot of my work is like, I make this joke in Pick a Fight, but it's not really a joke, is I'm trying to find ways to make work not suck. And right now, for most of the world of knowledge work, everybody's in this giant debate of how much of going back to the office should we have, right? We were working from home for a long period of time. It's kind of safe to come back now if you're vaccinated, et cetera, if you're recovered. There's less of a threat. If you've survived after 2 years, there's less of a threat at this point. And so we're trying to sort all that out. And what I'm trying to do is get as many people's attention as possible and go, whoa, like, let's have a larger conversation about what tasks should be done at work, rather than, hey, what? How much time are everybody going to come back? Because the way you make work suck is you force people to be there when there's nothing worth doing there, right? The office is a tool. It's not work. We've proven over the last 2 years that work can happen just about anywhere. That's why the book is called Leading From Anywhere. The newest book is called Leading From Anywhere. So now the big questions we're asking is, how do we make sure people are using this tool in a way that helps them do their best work without adding all of the stuff we used to hate about the office in the past, right? So those are probably the two big things I've been thinking on, focused on in the last, I don't know, few months.
Cool. Thank you so much for your time today, David. I was really excited to have this conversation and just hear you talk a bit about some of those things that I got out of reading that book, Friend of a Friend. So very much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.